Accession number 14972, Richard Atkinson, reel 5.
Mr. Atkinson, reel 5. Do you recall what kind of mileage you'd done from Belgium to France, Mr. Atkinson?
No, there was no record of mileage because you just went as it actually was dictated by what was on the roads and crowds, you know, refugees and things like that. So you could cover a lot and you could cover a little. You just didn't know. And there's no such thing as brakes, you just sort of headed in that, well, you knew you were heading in one direction. Well, it was marching pace.
What was the weather like?
It was hot, sunny, dusty. The weather, what do you think? Well, I can't remember any rain, any bad weather. There didn't seem to be any.
Could you say what the morale of the battalion was like in this withdrawal?
Oh, it was good. It was, I mean, it was the usual, as if it was just a manoeuvres, because we had never really bumped into Germans. I mean, you come through places and the wires was down, but the morale was good. There was never any, well, they're all singing and marching along, and there's a few women out in the pass of the song, "We Are the Durhams." So there was no fall of morale.
So your platoon truck was moving behind your platoon at this marching rate, marching and stopping because of refugees. What effect has that got on the vehicle itself, on the mechanics of it, or over long distances and long periods of time?
None, really, because they're very powerful trucks. You know, they're only 1,500 weights. That's what the platoons had. But they're a V8 engine, they're a massive engine, and it was hard work keeping them going slow. I'm talking about 3-4 miles an hour. It was, you know, the marching pace. They're marching at ease, the men, but no, there was never any mechanical fault. No, I can never remember. I didn't see a truck break down until we dumped them.
Where did you get your petrol from? Were you carrying your own reserve supply?
No, it was brought up somewhere. Somehow, it was there when you needed it. I mean, you had two big tanks on. I think it was about 15 gallon either side, maybe more. I can't remember exactly. But the petrol and the rations seemed to come up no trouble. There was never seemed to be any delay. You know, at night time, somebody would say, "There's petrol," and you're topped up and everything. First World War mentality again, like the horse, it had to be seen down before you did anything else. It just seemed to be there. And I don't think they had organised dumps, whether they were battalion headquarters was open, because we were companies where the headquarters would be behind us organising things somewhere.
1,500 weight trucks, what make were they?
A Ford. I had Fords. But, no, sorry, Standex corrected it. They were Guy vehicles and Morris commercials. There was a mixture of them. There are 1,500 weight guys with a big autovac. Kept hearing that sound as it pumped the petrol through. There were guys and Morris commercials.
Had they any peculiar fault on them?
Yes. It was a thing you had to listen to. When you were changing gears, you had to doubly clutch up and down, and you had to listen to the engine revs. And when you got to a certain pitch, you could drop into a lower gear and things like that. And it became automatic. The only fault was with the guy, because there's no hoods on, just canvas and canvas doors, a small windscreen, like an eye shield thing. And the battery box was between the driver and the second man. And the second man faced, he didn't look forward, his seat faced sideways out the door. And there was a big battery box, and you used to have to get your elbow on the battery box to knock it forward. Now. And you used to finish up with a sore elbow more than anything else, because it was heavy gear, but I suppose that was the modern thing of that day. Not like what they are now, with synchromesh. Now, it was no synchromesh. And you practically had to stop to go to the lower gear, or a four-wheel drive as well. There were a V8 engine, massive engine, and a four-wheel drive. So you had to stop to hit. If you're going up a hill, practically stop to go to the bottom gear or engage four-wheel drive.
The remainder of your march, when you crossed the borders from Belgium back into France, where did you go then?
Well, I think then we were heading towards Vimy, Le Bassy, that way on. But again, we didn't know. I mean, signposts was wrote in French, and that to us could have been anything. And we're just following the troops down the road. I mean, you're just going where you were sent, sort of style. But we finished up in that area.
What are your memories of Vimy Ridge?
Well, my first memory of Vimy Ridge is when it was my first taste of baptism of fire. We were going up the hill. It was a beautiful sunny afternoon. Going up the hill past the Canadian Cemetery, the big memorial thing. And this plane came over, marked it and put a ring or something in the sky, and the Stukas came, and that was their aim and point. And they stuck at us, and they hit. We dived into the cemetery, you know, you just switched the ignition off the truck and bailed out and left it, because there's nothing you could do, and he was aiming for that. And dive into the cemetery, and the next thing we remember is a top going off the memorial and gravestones going up. Oh my God. And then when they went away, come back to the trucks and just drove on.
What was your feelings, as you say, it was your very first action under fire, and these were Stukas that you'd never ever met before?
Petrified. Hadn't a clue. Really, you know, you're trembling. You didn't know what it was, you hadn't a clue. And I said prayers I didn't know I was capable of saying. You know, you're asking for your mother even, things like that. So when you think back, it's stupid, but it was your first baptism, and you just didn't know what to expect or what to do even, because you're impotent. You had no means of hitting back at them. You know, just sort of lying there, getting as far away from the truck as possible in case he hit it, and the stuff went up. And then when it cleared, you just got in, and after that, you knew what to expect, and you could sort of be in your garden. When you saw a thing, you could run.
Did it get any better for you when you got more experience of Stukas?
Yes, it did, to be honest. You got to a certain stage where you used to watch for the bomb coming down, because you could tell if he's aiming at you or not, even run around to the side of a tree or the back of a wall, because these were little tricks you picked up. You said, oh, well, he's aiming for someone over there, someone there. And you just got your head down, of course, in case anything flying about. But you learned to do and not to do. Let's put it that way. You know, it was one of those things you just picked up with experience.
Were there any casualties at this point that you saw for the first
time?
No,
I didn't see any. I didn't see any. Whether there was... No, honestly, I couldn't say that if I saw any. I don't think I never saw an ambulance or a stretcher bearer. I never even heard any shouts for medics.
What date was this as you approached Vimy Ridge, in that area?
Oh, well into May. Well into May. I can't remember. Oh, I would think round about 22nd, somewhere like that. I couldn't say exactly, but I know the 10th of May the balloon went up early morning. We went in, and this was a make. Now we were dashed in. Well, by the time we went, round about that time, I couldn't see off exactly.
On the ridge itself, did you get involved in the counterattack of that time?
No.
What was your role?
Well, we were just sitting there looking on. Actually, as usual, no word came down. You just stopped there, and you were. Well, just watch what was unfurled. The first thing we saw was some French tanks come up, and an officer grabbed them, and he made them go forward to where there was troops in the front. Now, we didn't even know that was the 6th or the 8th Battalion. We just saw these people going forward over the fields and whatnot, because you didn't use roads. And actually, we were more concerned looking at the barbed wire and stuff from the First World War and the trenches they had, because had been sandbagged like cemented, and, you know, and we were more concerned and watching the troops going forward. It was like the old-fashioned days when it's hard for the horses and things like that. You know, it was like watching a film, to be honest. When you think of it now, at the time you didn't. You just said, oh, there's someone going forward. You didn't know there was a battle going on even. Oh, if there was going to be a battle.
Could you see any of the action going on in the distance?
No, you couldn't. You saw them go forward, then all of a sudden these tanks come scarfing back. Then we move back. You know, it was one of those things, you know, you turn around and transport.
And where did you move to?
I think we must have come down at the Carvin or somewhere like that from there. Because that, where we come, it had to be Carvin or that area. Because I remember we were in a village next to a school wall, and that's when I heard the bullets, machine guns and spandos. And that was there. By this time I'd learned to recognise what he was firing at us, whether it was spandos or automatics or what. And we were in Carvin, because I was standing with my officer. I'm sure it was a school wall, or the school was behind us or something. And we're discussing where they would have the 1500, the platoon truck, and bang, it must have been a mortar. And the sergeant was dead. Sergeant Edwards, my sergeant, he was from Sunderland.
Sergeant?
Edwards, Norman Edwards. And he was dead.
And was this beside you, close to you?
Yeah, close to us. The three were standing talking together. And I'm not sure whether Stanley Cunningham, my officer, was killed as well. I don't know, but we buried Edwards, and I think we buried Mr. Cunningham, I think. But now, I want to go back and see, and I've contacted Graves Commission, Commonwealth Graves Commission, and they've informed me Sergeant Edwards has no known grave. But Stanley Cunningham, Second Lieutenant Cunningham from Hexham, is buried in St. Omer. But, I mean, that's how they do things. But that was beside a school wall, and I'm sure it was carving that area, and the machine gun bullets. And then the carriers come up and sort of extracted us, and we came back through Second and Avenue.
Was this your closest you've been to
casualties? We found out that, you know, like later on in the day, that was these German advance parties with the motorbikes with the Spandau machine gun and whatnot on. And they had either run to us or we had run to them. But that was our first experience of close quarter fighting. Let's put then my experience with the 9th. I mean, I couldn't say for other regiments, but that was my first experience. And as usual, petrified again, not knowing what to do. It was one of those things, and who to turn to, what to do next. Of course, someone would take command and organise things.
What was your initial reaction to seeing someone you knew closely dead at your feet, almost?
I think I was numb. I don't think I realised I was numb. And I'll tell you what it did to me. It made me petrified of blood. Even now, if one of my children cut their finger, I had to turn away. I'm absolutely petrified of blood since. And when anyone gets hurt, there's no way I can go and help them. Just through that, you know, it was one of those things that pity. And when the fellows get wounded, I couldn't help them, I had to turn away. But if I got wounded, there's no one got away. So, you know, that was the way they all had to come and help me. But it really, it stunned us, let's put it that way.
So was your initial reaction to the death of your sergeant to go away and leave him?
No. If I can think, I think I looked at him, because he was mutilated. And we just sort of scooped a hole in some soft earth and put him in. Made sure his discs was on him and stuck a rifle with his helmet or something on. But, it was just disbelief. I never expected it. Never happened to you before. And you just, you were, actually, it was one of those things that was just automatic. You'd never been instructed to do anything like that, to be honest, in the army. They never told you anything like that. And it was, you just made sure it never happened again. You know, you sort of kept away from it. But it definitely affected your mind and your nerve, even to this day.
Did anger come into your feelings at a later date, anything like that?
Actually, I was just a young boy. I shouldn't have been there. I was underage in the first place. But No, there's no anger. Actually, you never thought of the Germans, to be honest. They never entered your mind. They were just enemy that was trying to hit you. I can remember the bullets zinging through the telegraph wires and things like that and hitting the wall and bouncing off and, you know, ricocheting away. But, no, you never thought of the Germans. There was never any anger. It was just them and you, sort of stuff.
After carving, do you recall the route that you took?
Well, I think we came down. Well, someone says we're going back to reorganise. And I think we came back down to Popperinge. Is it Popperinge? I think we came that way down. And I can never remember any more action or fighting. Came down, we marched down a road, because they're not roads like what we know now, you know, the roads. And I can remember the Belgian troops coming through us with their red blankets on, running away, each one a red blanket. And we were stopping, manning road barriers, stopping the refugees, blocking the roads up. And the planes took us, machine gunning the roads, the civilians diving either side to get away from them, and us, of course. I can remember that, you know, the planes was harassing the roads all the time. But all you did was switch off and jumped amongst, you know, the ditches and what the side. But it was crowded with refugees, and you sort of had to clear the way through them and stop them and things like that.
What were your feelings for these people who were being machine gunning?
It didn't enter your mind. Never give them a second thought. All you're concerned with was stopping with your regiment, because you were, by this time you're getting scattered about. Some was going forward, the Stukas wasn't touching them, they were still advancing, and the refugees were getting amongst you, and your one concern was this, sort of keeping up with your mates and, you know, being not left and lost. Oh, you looked at them as they're driving past you, pushing barras and prams and stuff like that past you, but they were seemed to be going in the opposite direction to you all the time. But then never ever entered your mind. Even if they were dead, by this time you looked at them and just carried on going.
There's no communication between you
none
and them?
None whatsoever. The Red Caps and the regimental police and that was just trying to stop them coming through or clear the road and make sure you got through. Oh no, there was never any, ever, well, they couldn't speak the language, but there was never, well, you see, you know, shift, sort of thing.
Was there much indication of destruction of equipment and lorries and bodies around at all?
By this time, no, there were, all the destruction you saw was in the villages and that where wires was down and you had sort of pushing through and, you know, where you had bombed or shelled or whatever it was, and there was destruction in the villages and the houses and rubble and stuff like that. Or you might park put the vehicle alongside a wall and you'd machine gun and all the slates would come off the roof and scatter around about you, things like that. But there was no destruction of army vehicle, of British material. There's nothing like that at this stage. Because as you got near to Dunkirk.
At what point did you know or had been told that you were going to come out of France?
Well, we're never ever told we'll come out of France. Never ever. The only order that I ever received was, if anything goes wrong, make for that black smoke, because Dunkirk oil towers was thrown big plumes of black smoke for days and days in the air where it was burning. Make for the black smoke, we're reorganising there. That was the only orders we ever received as regards where we're going and what to do. And you just sort of headed in that direction.
Do you recall the, as you approached Dunkirk, being involved in other activities, other actions?
No. There was no more activities like that until we came into Le Pan on the beach. And by this time, everything was scattered. As you come in, I say, no, Durham's over there, something like that. Or the guards was sort of trying to get a scratch mob. But we went into action, but then again, I can't remember the names of things. But the Durham's held a place somewhere, and they just roped any stragglers in to be with us. We still have our transport intact by this time. And then the orders was issued for to destroy it. Some of it they tried to keep some, but the orders were then for to destroy it.
And did you destroy your truck?
Well, yes. I can remember driving down a road, and there was a red cap standing. Someone said he's a fifth columnist, we don't know. And we turned down a lane, and there was all the fellas destroying the trucks. You just left them open, run, smashed the something they got. But all the equipment was left on, Bren guns, ammunition, everything, blankets. Rum ration was even left on. And we still didn't know. Well, by this time, I was separated from the Durhams. I'd lost them. I was on my own somewhere in the vicinity of Dunkirk. And I can remember coming onto the beach, well, the sand dunes, and I was at Doughty because we had no sleep. That was a bugbear. No sleep. You couldn't keep your eyes open, and you'd wake up and they were gone. And you sort of had to find your way. But they were only cat naps, but it seemed like ages. But come onto the beach, and I put my head down. I was with no other Durhams by this time. I think I was with some engineers from Devon. And I put my head down, and somebody reckon I slept for about a day, 24 hours. And the next thing I recall was a Frenchman shaking me and giving us something to eat. What it was, I don't know. And there was a big, like a big building, and someone said it was a nunnery. Then afterwards, I think we found out it was a casino, to be honest. But we're just on our own. You sort of made your way down to water's edge to try and get off. Still, no one ever told you anything. You made your way down to water's edge. By this time, it was getting the end of May, beginning of June. Then all of a sudden, a sailor come along and says, get into the line. And we sort of ambled along one night, in the middle of the night, to this mool. Came off. That was the 1st of June. But then, by this time, I had no contact with the Durhams for about 2 days by this time. As a ship come alongside, it just slowly just jumped on. Don't ask me what the name of the ship was, I couldn't tell you. All I know was I jumped on.
What was the scene like on the beach when you got there? What was going on around you?
Well, it was just gangs of people sort of together. During the day, you scrambled a hole in the sand dunes. You kept off the beach because you used machine gun and stuff was coming over. At first, they tried to wade out, and you couldn't, so you came back. And then, in these sand dunes, and just kept your head down during the hours of daylight.
Was there much enemy air activity against you?
Well, there was a bit, yes. I mean, it only needed a little bit, because by this time, we were bomb happy. If anybody was like a bomb coming down, you got under cover. Because we had no air support at all. And you just had the freedom of the sky. You looked. By the time you didn't even look to see if it was a bomb, you just got out in the cover. But the Navy organized this, and as I say, I jumped on the ship and I came across. So I couldn't tell you the name of it or what it was, hadn't I?
Was that a good journey over? You were attacked or anything like that?
No, we weren't attacked. It was in the hours of darkness. So it must have been. Because it was just breaking daylight, or just light, when we come into Dover. Oh, Ramsgate, one of those ports. I couldn't tell you which one, but it was that area. We came in, and they just put us on trains, and I finished up in Blandford Camp in Dorset.
What was the reception like as you got off the boat? Were there people there to see to you?
No, there was people giving you tea and cigarettes, which you already had cigarettes. But the people there dishing tea out, and you just sort of got on this train. Because I don't think there's such a thing as regiments. You're just in a heap. And you just got no carriage. And you went, as I say, I finished up in Blandford Camp. And I believe the regiment was in Ridgely and somewhere like that. But I finished up in Blandford Camp in Dorset. And actually coming there, I think it was dark. And we just went in this room, this barrack room. There's beds made up on the floor, as usual. Got in, and the next morning, an ATS girl came around with tea and woke us up. And the officer of the camp played holy hell with her. These men should have been allowed to sleep. You go and let us sleep, but she had woke us up with tea. Just got up, and then it was so scattered you fell in on the parade ground in divisions. So we fell in under 50 TT. I think twice a day you just fell in, and until he got organised and sent you back to the regiment.
And how many days were you there?
I don't know, to be honest. I haven't a clue. It could have been a week, could have been anything. I don't know.
Do you recall the date that you landed from France?
I think it was June the 1st, I think. Well, it would be the night, June the 1st, 2nd, it was night time.
What state were you in, uniform-wise and so on?
Well, your uniform wasn't very good because you had been messing around in sand dunes and in the water and whatnot. I had a lot of cigarettes. I kept those. My rifle, of course, that was a must. Yeah. I lost my equipment. It was on the vehicle when I lost the vehicle. I lost my equipment. I had my rifle, tin hat, and I don't think I had a tunic, if I remember correctly.
Were you re-equipped at this first camp?
No, nothing. Not a thing. You were just there, and you're just fed, and they wouldn't let you out because you were no fit state to go to a place like that, so they just kept you in there, and they entertained you in there, but you were just a raggy mob.
You weren't debriefed in any way, where you had nothing. To say where you'd been and what had happened?
No, I mean, it was you went in the mess room, and somebody was like a bomb, and everybody was on the table. It was that sort of atmosphere, but there was no that business. You just sort of hung around there until they got organised.
Where did you go to next?
I think the battalion of the division must have been in the Stavish area, Ridgely area, because I joined them, was re-equipped, reclothed, as if I hadn't been away, back to the quartermaster stores, because I was with headquarter company by this time. The company wasn't organised, and I was in headquarter company, which I was in. Originally, I was in headquarter company, attached to C company, which I'd never left. Because I joined C company, and I was made transport, headquarters, reattached back to C company. So, headquarters by this time, and we came back to Blandford and Lymebury, just on the coast.
Did you get any leave? But
yes, I got a 48-hour leave.
That was all you got
That's all I got, yes, 48-hour. That didn't include the travelling time, mind you know, so it must have been like a 4-day thing, because by the time we got up, and I had a 48-hour leave then back.
Did your family expect to see you?
Well, actually, the quartermaster, the company colour sergeant, C company, was a fellow called Dodger Green, and before the war, I was an apprentice bricklayer, and he was my labourer. That was the territorials all over again. And when war came, he was my dishing orders out, and was still bricklayer and labourer. And he called home to my mother and said, oh, by the way, Dick's not coming back. He's been shot out of hand for some reason. And he didn't even see us. I don't think he might have been with C company still. I don't know. And when I walked in the door, she couldn't believe her eyes.
But it's been a dreadful shock for your mother.
You see, she couldn't contact me because there was no information, no warning. Until I pulled in, and I never thought of ringing anything like that, in those days, you're just young and daft, and you just said, let's go. But she says to me, Dodger's been, that was his nickname, Dodger's been, he said, you were shot at the hand. I said, well, I wasn't, I'm here.
How was the civilian population, in your experience, how did they take this retreat from France?
Well, we were heroes. That's what we couldn't understand. We were all saying, but we were chased out, were a rabble, were disorganised, and yet they, because it was propaganda, and it worked, that we were all heroes. You know, people was coming, good seeing Dunkirk, because I only had a pair of trousers on and things like that, and a shirt. You hadn't, I would have a battle dress blouse by this time, but, they could tell that where you were from. And actually, and you stuck Dunkirk on your shoulder, you're playing it up, as all forces do.
You had a flash with Dunkirk on.
Well, we made a flash, out of something, put Dunkirk on. Of course, and that's, when you're back in the regiment, the first thing it says, get that down.
So after 4 days, you came back to Ruislip?
I think that area, I couldn't say exactly.
What condition was the battalion in when you rejoined them?
Oh, shambles. Well, just in fields and whatnot, sort of organised, sorting themselves out. And as we're coming in, we're saying, oh, yes, you're Atkinson, yes, you can carry on there, and you're sort of picking things up, and we're getting reinforcements. And also, I remember, a fellow had been in France with us, and he had a medical, and he was suddenly discharged. And I says to him, he was a corporal. Fellows, I think they called him. Fellow, something like that. And I says, what's the matter? He says, oh, they suddenly decide I've got brass poisoning because I work in a brass foundry. And so on, he says, but he was discharged from there. So they're sorting him out and getting reinforcements in and getting organised. A bit better than what they were in 39.